How much was there in the way of air support during your time?
There was a phrase bandied around amongst the officers: come up for a beer and an airstrike. And if you went to see somebody in the forward company, any time you were in the forward company, there was a fair chance that you might come at a time of a napalm airstrike on the Chinese hills opposite, which we knew nothing about. It wasn't going to happen. But if you were there and you did happen, then you saw it explode, and you, if you had any sense, you got your head down. Because even at 1,000 yards, the wave of hot air that came across was enormous, and it wouldn't blister the skin, but it was uncomfortable. And you turn your back on it or something, or cover your ears, or because it was nasty. And that was happening all the time, about twice a week. But it was American air support. Now we had Auster-like planes, which were nearly one of them. I think we had about three or four, and they were part of the gunner command, and they flew over the Chinese lines for anti-artillery. This was quite important, because if you got heavy guns, then we had a counter-bombardment battery that had listening posts, and I knew, not everyone knew, but I knew where the microphones were, because they took sound bearings on where the guns were being fired. And then if you had several of these, it would help you to pinpoint where the Chinese battery was, and you could shell it. And we kept them on the move, we, the Commonwealth Division, like that, because we could identify the and added with to the agents. You see, the agents on their trips up the Samichon were looking out for this sort of thing, for the gun batteries, and it all sort of came together in information terms to help in the dominance and the anti-gunner duels, which you see, you've had anti-sniper work and anti-gunnery. The tanks didn't do much. They were dug in hull down positions, so that only the turret was showing, and they were useful. But we went into one position, Seymour and I, where it was being shelled by howitzers, and we dived under the tank for shelter until we realised that it must be the tank that was being shelled, and the tank realised it as well, and it got the message first, and it moved off, and it didn't know we were underneath and it backed off down the position and started to go down the hill, and there we were blinking like owls in the sunshine. And Seymour said, "What do we do now?" I said, "See that tree over there?" It was about 500-600 yards, a little clump of trees. I said, "Run like hell." And the shelling hadn't been in that area, but once they saw the tank had gone, they stopped. And but it took them, they were very methodical. They'd fire a battery of maybe six guns, and they'd each fire, and then they'd stop and they'd reload. And reloading must have been fairly antiquated equipment. It was about 3 minutes between firing. You could almost, you had a fairly good idea of when it was going to start again. And we'd already seen some of this, because on the camouflage road position, I got a bang on the shin on one occasion when I had about six people with me, and I stayed on the top of the hill. And you had to go down this forward slope, which got shelled occasionally. And I sent them down in twos immediately after they were only firing with two guns, I think, because they were coming in, boom, boom, and then at an interval. And when I went down, there was a flash in front of me, and I just started off running. And this big black and orange flash, it seemed to be crude explosive, because of this colour, it's inefficient explosive, almost gunpowder. I say this because they used gunpowder in the mines that in the village where I grew up in, and you could buy the odd stick off the deputies and shot firers round about November the 5th to make your own fireworks. And so I knew about gunpowder. And anyway, I threw myself on my back, but I had one leg up, and I got a hell of a thump on the shin. And I stood up and I tried to hobble, but my leg was numb, and I used my rifle as a crutch, and I got down at the bottom. And down at the bottom, the shell couldn't get in there because of the other hill. And they took my puttee off, all the skin had gone off here. Whether it was with a stone or a piece of shrapnel, I don't know, but I've still got a huge piece of scar tissue there, which flares up occasionally. But I didn't go to the medical officer, because my mother would have got a telegram, which wasn't necessary. I could hobble around for a few days and it would get better. And I think there were three occasions when I got clipped, as they say, but didn't report it. But that was considered part of the game. You didn't bother the medical officer if you could put a sticking plaster on it.
Is that the generally accepted practice then?
It's what?
Is that the generally accepted practice?
Yes. I think there were three times. I ran into a picket once after the picket was sticking out of it was on the hook, and we had heavy shelling for 5 days beforehand. And I ran round a corner, and there's this picket sticking out, and it clipped my steel helmet, stuck it up, and stuck in my head. And I just backed off, and it bled for a bit, and then I had a bump on my head for a while. I wasn't handicapped in any way. And there was a third occasion, which I've forgotten. I can't remember what it was now. 3 times lucky, time to leave. Mobile laundry and bath unit. An unusual animal. We had one in each brigade run by the Ordnance Corps. Apparently the pump that drove the hot water to the showers, that pumped it round, was a Morris Minor engine. But apart from that, that's the only technicality I know about it. But I went to use it when we were on Nai Chon, which would be about February or March, and to have the first bath that I'd had since October, which is a long time. We changed our clothes most days. You changed your boots every day. In fact, changing boots was a section leader's supervisory duty, and he had to look at the men's feet so they didn't get drenched feet and so on. And you were supposed to change your socks, and if you hadn't spare socks to change into, you change your, put your socks inside out, put them back on again. And Seymour and I tried washing in the stream below Yongdong before Christmas, and we had to break through 4 inches of ice, and I vowed I'd never do it again. And I spoke to the quartermaster sergeant who supplied us, and after that we got new socks every week, whatever we wanted. Anyway, I'm walking down the road with my rifle, because it was about 3 kilometres back, and I'd got permission to go off. I felt after getting into my third month I could do with a shower, do with a bath. And because you didn't take your boots off, you didn't undress, you got in the sleeping bag fully clothed, because you were expected to come out fighting if need be. And in the winter, your rifle went in with you as well, in your sleeping bag, because otherwise, I mixed up a mixture of graphite from a 4B pencil and gun oil, and smeared it on my boat, so it never froze after that. The graphite didn't freeze, the only the oil, and there wasn't enough oil to. And every morning at daybreak, you did a weapons test on your automatic weapons, because they had a chance of freezing up overnight. So the cold was very intense. It got down below minus 20 at times. And the bath unit. I'm walking down the road past the reserve company position, and I get a call from the hillside above me. And it turned out to be a chap three streets back from me in my village, who at my age had been to the village school. I hadn't seen him for about 2 years. He'd gone off to join the Paras, because his brother had been in the Paras. I wrote a poem for him about him. He was called Portrait of a Yorkshire Soldier, and it was published in the Duke of Wellington's Iron Duke magazine 3 months ago. But he failed selection in the paratroops. His brother had been in wartime, his elder brother. And we exchanged. I didn't know he was there, but he'd been sent up as a reinforcement. And I went off the bath and I had my bath and came back, and all was well. But he went on to be a section leader, corporal, with the dog company that ended up on the Hook and was overrun by the Chinese in the Hook battle. And he had to go into the tunnels with his section. They each had a tunnel. And the Chinese threw in satchel charges of TNT to blow the tunnel. They succeeded in about two cases, but in most cases, whoever was inside in the blackness and what have you had enough vision to see the satchel charge being thrown in, and they would run up to it and like a football and kick it out back towards the Chinese. And the second in command of the battalion, Major Kelsey, happened to be in one of the tunnels at the time when the battle was going on, and he kicked one out and got a foot damaged. And Corporal Pickersgill was another who did it in another tunnel, and Eddie told me later that it hadn't happened in his tunnel. They kept quiet and the Chinese didn't in fact find them, and the counterattack went in about, the battle started at 8 o'clock at night with the Chinese coming in through their own barrage and taking casualties from their own artillery fire, but they were in our lines, in our trenches, before anybody knew what was going on, and a fair amount of hand-to-hand fighting went on till they got out section by section and into their tunnel. And then the counterattack went in from two ways, from Charlie Company, which was on the other, on Sausage, you had the Hook position, and then you had a position behind A Company, the Reserve Company, and you had the Assault Pioneers here. They weren't involved in the counterattack, but A Company came up here and up the hill, and they gradually cleared the area. It took about an hour, and Mike Campbell Lamberton, the Scottish International, came in from Charlie Company, and Gilbert Smith, another Scottish International, came from A Company and met on the top. And by that time, they went into tunnels, because our defensive fire tasks were to fire our own 25 pounders airburst onto the Hook, so that the surface was uninhabitable by the Chinese, and our own men inside would, but not many Chinese got on, and not many got in the tunnels, and they committed a division of three brigades, each of about 3,000 men, and they even put in their reserve brigade, and so they committed 9,000 men against a one company position basically, and still didn't get in. So it, but it was, there were, they they removed most of their dead, and it was thought that they took about 3,000 casualties. And we had about, over the week concerned, we had about 30 dead and about 100 wounded. But we were short of NCOs after that, as a battalion, because many of the casualties had been NCOs, which I suppose you'd expect. And Eddie was on the hook, but he wasn't involved. I think that about clears my list.
Knowledge did you have of the situation in Korea before you arrived?
Got to Korea. A fair amount. Enough to get me interested to volunteer to go, which received rather an odd response. My training company in York was commanded by a Green Howard officer, and he said, "Why don't you join the Green Howards? You're wearing the cap badge." I said, "They're in Malaya and they're due to come back in 3 months' time to form a second battalion." "Oh, you know," he said. I said, "Yes." I said, "And I've decided that I'm probably not officer material the way I'm going on here, and so I would like to see some proper soldiering if I have to be a soldier for 2 years, and so I'd like to go to the Yorkshire battalion that's going to Korea." He said, "You must be mad. Everybody else is going in the opposite direction." I didn't reply, and it happened. And I went out with this group of 45 that, and I didn't tell people that I'd volunteered. And I was soon in hot water again in Germany, because I was on the regimental police, as I mentioned. I got thrown off the regimental police for causing a traffic jam while I was on point duty outside the barracks. It wasn't true, but the facts were indisputable. Say Thursday, I approached the Sergeant Mills, the provost sergeant, and said, "You know, I don't particularly like this job. What are the chances of going back to a rifle company? I was in Charlie Company before, and I'd like to go back." He said, "You're doing perfectly well where you are." I said, "And I need the men, and there'll be no replacement if you go, so you're not bloody going, and that's it." Next day, I'm on point duty. This is Minden in Germany, and there were two tram lines came down the centre of the road, and not much room outside the trams for the traffic, and certainly no, only a cycle track between the two of them. And behind the barracks behind us, we had what was called a GSO, the German Service Organisation. It was a transport outfit of 3-ton trucks driven by Ukrainians, and there were about 400 on them. Anyway, a convoy was coming out to go somewhere, and there was a tram stop just below the barracks entrance. I think one of the drivers of the truck must have got a bit bored with me not letting him out, and half blocked a track, and they were backed up right through the barracks then, and they, you know, the whole damn thing. And Sergeant Mills came fussing out like a little old woman. "You bastard," he said. "You've done this deliberately to get back to a rifle company." I was posted next day. But then I didn't get out of hot water then, because I was put into a platoon and sent on a wireless operator's course. And I came out top of the course, and my platoon, I didn't know this, and the platoon commander sent for me, and he said, I'm delighted you've done so well. He said, you can be my Batman wireless operator in Korea. He said, I've been looking for somebody to do this job. It's a very important job. I said, well, thank you very much, sir, but I don't mind the wireless operator job, but I don't think I'm cut out to be anybody's Batman. And he stiffened up and he said, this isn't a discussion, Winspear. That's an order. I said, thank you, sir. I'm sorry. Marched out. Went to see the company sergeant major and I told him the story. He said, you'll have to go on company commander's orders tomorrow morning. He said, you've only been back 5 minutes. You're causing bloody trouble again already. And so I see the company commander and he said more or less the same. And he said, well, you can't stay here. He said, I'll have to try to find a new berth for you. He said, I'll go and look at your records. And he sent for me the next day and he said, you're a surprising chap. He said, you've got 4 A-levels. One of them's geography. And you've done French and German. And you were recommended for commission and pulled out of the officer training cadre. He said, but you're a marksman on all weapons as well. He said, so I'm sending you to the sniper section. And there the IO decided I was better in the intelligence side rather than sniping, but I could double up on both sides. But my platoon commander wouldn't speak to me again, and he's now General Sir Ian Huxtable. It was the best post-school education I could have had. I couldn't say I enjoyed it because there were too many extremes for that, but it was certainly extremely stimulating, and it set me up for life. I mean, I wouldn't be in property now and owing half a dozen building societies half a million if I hadn't learned how to take risks and knowingly and to judge the chances and so on. but the greatest value, I think, was getting to know soldiers intimately in the best possible sense, and to see good. The minefield chap, by all army standards, he spent half his time in close arrest, drunk. The only thing he was interested in was chasing the NAFI manageress, and so on. But he and I became quite friendly because he was a colourful character, and that appealed to me. And nobody else in that group would have done what he did. I think we'd have got out, because, as I say, I would have taken them the other way. But, you know, there's good in everybody, in the right circumstances. And I take my hat off to him for that. But these odd things were the highlights of my experience. I mean, Dan Glackham with his Japanese girls and so on. It wasn't the first time he'd done that, I'm sure. When he was in Malaya doing his 3-year Python, he'd done it before. Mm-hmm. But this is life. This is what people are. This is what they do. And they've all got sort of different sides to their character that come out. And you develop a bond that goes without saying. I've mentioned this chap in New York that I see occasionally. I happened to say to him once, I said, because we'd read this, I said, what happened to Greatrex? He said, the stupid bastard. He said, I sent him for the water. He was in his section, you see, we'd been in the same platoon. He said, I sent him for the water with another bloke, whose name I'd forgotten. He said, every evening, like everybody else. And I said, don't go over the top, because this was on the hook, on the sausage position, right forward company on the triangle. And he said, but they went over the top, and the Chinese gave him 2 minutes, and then mortared at the bottom of the hill, and they both got hit. He said, and Greatrex lost a leg. He said it went like this. He said I got the water can. There were black cans with white stripes in the convolutions, so they were different from the petrol cans. And he said, I poured it into an old tin hat that I'd got used to wash the water. I washed my hands, I washed my face. Then I shouted for him, and I sent him, and I said, don't go over the top. Going round in the communication trench was a lot further, but they went over the top. And he said, but I gave him the can to go off. He said, and I started washing, and I heard the Chinese mortars fire. And he said, I bloody knew. He said, the stupid bastard had gone over the top. So I finished washing and I went round the communication, and they were being picked up at the bottom and taken to the RAP, Regimental Age Post, which was only about 100 yards further on. But, you know, it luck, they talk, but not luck. I mean, it paid to be careful. And if you weren't... If you didn't stick to the rules and the precaution, you were looking for trouble. Hence Geordie France, and he's wanting to see the Chinese lights.
What's the main question of your staying on, signing on as a regular?
I didn't know I'd been recommended for a commission. Nobody told me anything about it. And I left like everybody else. There was nothing said in the Dukes, but when I got back to Hallamshire's, the adjutant looked up my record and found all this. And so I was asked to... I was a conscript then, still, because you had 4 years compulsory service to do. And indeed you had to fire every year a range course, and you had to go to 2 weeks camp, and if you missed your range course you were up before the beak in the magistrate's court in Sheffield the following Tuesday and fined £200. So you had to go, and I stayed in that position for about 2 years, and I didn't volunteer until after I was commissioned. But when I went to the cadet school at Mons, and I bumped into Major Kavanagh, who had been my company commander, who was a lieutenant colonel then. I came out top of that course, and I was with a B plus grading as an officer cadet, and a recommendation of a regular commissions board. Now, if I'd accepted that, nearly all the officers at that time were on short-term commissions, and regular commissions were reserved for what they thought were the best people. But I was already in the civil service as an executive officer. I was on the point of getting married. I couldn't see any exciting wars around the corner, so I didn't take up the opportunity. And if I had, which that was the continued service, I might have ended up a general or something. But it didn't happen. So, but.